The Bob Murphy Show, Episode 19.
There's a tidal wave coming. What you gonna do?
Get ready for another episode of The Bob Murphy Show, the podcast promoting free markets, free minds, and grateful souls. It's your source for commentary and interviews conducted by a Christian and economist. Now here's your host, Bob Murphy.
Welcome everyone to another episode of The Bob Murphy Show. Let me first take a moment to explain why the frequency of episodes is somewhat higher lately. And that's because, number one, I wanted to get this episode you're listening to now out there to perform its function, as I'll explain in a moment. And I had already recorded the interviews ahead of time and labeled them, so I really couldn't slip this one in. I had to go ahead and just accelerate the earlier ones, the release. But also because part of what I said to you guys when I set up the option for contributions was that, hey, if you guys come through, I can start doing these things more often. And many of you did come through, and I appreciate that very much. For those who have yet to contribute, you can go to bobmurphyshow.com/contribute to see the special bonuses involved if your mere Kantian duty isn't enough to motivate you. So now for this episode, what are we talking about? The title says, Why Rothbardian Institutions Would Become Nonviolent. And so what I'm going to argue for in this episode is that in a libertarian world, one that largely respects the non-aggression principle, let's just call it Rothbard land, for lack of a better term, the major institutions, you know, the big companies, and in particular, the agencies that deal with crime minimization, including that of invasion from foreign states that still exist, I'm saying all of those institutions would very quickly tend towards being nonviolent. And I'm not saying that in terms of a moral stance. I'm just saying that is my prediction as an economist as to what would happen. Just like if I'm an economist and you ask me what would happen if we legalized the market for all recreational drugs, I could sit there and tell you what would happen. Oh, I think the potency would go down in certain things and overdoses would drop and da-da-da-da. And this many people might start using da-da-da. And that would have nothing to do with my personal views as to whether drug use was moral or immoral. I would just be talking as an economist. So same thing here. Even though I do have my own moral views on the subject of the use of violence, that has nothing to do with what I'm going to be talking about in this particular episode of The Bob Murphy Show. All I'm saying is, as an economist who has thought through this matter, I think more than most, it seems to me pretty obvious that the institutions in a Rothbardian society would, over time, and I think pretty quickly, move towards being relatively nonviolent. So why do I want to talk about this? What's got me thinking along these lines is that, as many of you know, on the upcoming Contra Cruise for 2019, details at ContraCruise.com, I'm actually going to be debating Tom Woods, who is the co-host of the Contra Cruise. So the specific resolution, and the reason we're doing this is because Gene Epstein is a featured guest for this particular cruise, and Gene is the founder and host of the Soho Forum. And so it's only fitting that, hey, while Gene's on the cruise, how about Tom and I debate something? And this is the resolution we came up with, because we wanted to pick something that was important, but yet where Tom and I legitimately disagree. And so there'd be an actual clash here where we're both arguing for something we believe in and we're disagreeing with each other. So the specific wording we agreed upon was the following. Resolved, a pacifist society is morally and practically superior to one using defensive violence. Okay, so just to make sure you understand what we're arguing, I am going to be taking the position that a society that renounces even defensive violence, right? So Tom and I both agree offensive violence, the initiation of aggression in particular, is off limits. And a society that refrains from doing that is both morally superior and would actually do better practically than a society that employs offensive violence. Tom and I both agree on that. That's what it means to be a libertarian. But I'm saying, even if we now restrict ourselves to the class of libertarian societies, I am saying those that refrain from even using defensive violence are going to be better off practically, and I'm going to argue are morally superior to those that still engage in or tolerate the use of defensive violence. Okay, so that's what we're debating on the Contra Cruise. And so it occurred to me as I was thinking this through, getting ready for the debate, that there's really no way I can put this, folks, except just to say it. I've thought about this stuff for years, and I know Tom hasn't. And so it's just not going to work if we walk into the debate and I unload stuff on him. I mean, it would be like if we're playing chess and he didn't know about castling, right? I mean, sure, I would win, but it would be a boring game because I could just play pretty defensively and just castle and then boom, and you know, that wouldn't be very much fun at all. And so it'd be like 4 months, 5 months ahead of time, I would let Tom know, by the way, do you know you're allowed to do this in chess? And then he's shocked. And then he goes and starts thinking about it and revising his strategy. So likewise, part of what I'm doing in this episode is I got to bring Tom up to speed because he just hasn't thought this stuff through as much as I have. So I got to bring him along for the ride, bring him up to speed so we can have a good debate. So let me be clear. Let me reassure those of you who have already registered for the Contra Cruise. And by the way, folks, we'll record the episode, you know, just because we should have that somewhere for posterity, but we're not going to release it to the general public. That what you're getting, part of what you're getting if you go on the Contra Cruise this year, is you get to see this debate. And so don't worry if you've already registered or thinking of registering. I'm not going to spoil it by talking about it right now. On the contrary, I'm giving you and Tom some help here and giving you the framework so you can think through this stuff. Because partly I want you to understand what I'm even saying. As you'll see, it'll take me a whole episode here just to help communicate the framework that I've got in mind so you can see where I'm coming from. Because that's partly what I want to do here is just make sure you realize, let me put it this way. Maybe I'm wrong, but I'm not so wrong that somebody could just disprove what I'm saying in 2 seconds. Okay, so it's, and I've written on pacifism before for LouRockwell.com, for example, years ago when I was in grad school. And a lot of the pushback I got was just, you know, it was the same kind of thing as if I were to say to somebody, to a regular person who's never thought about it, oh, I think there should be a free market in police, in the legal system, and military defense. And you can imagine some normal person, let's say, like, listens to Sean Hannity every day, the kind of responses they would give me, that's what I was getting from LouRockwell.com readers when I would talk about pacifism. Because it was clear they hadn't really thought about it, and what they had thought about it was just a 2-second caricature. And oh, that's stupid. I'll move on with my life because that guy's an idiot and he's immoral and a scumbag and a coward, right? Okay, so no, you can't dispose of it that easily. So what I'm doing in this episode, again, I'm not here trying to convince you of pacifism. So if your stomach muscles are all clenched up, you're like, oh, Murphy, are you trying to tell me I got to get rid of my gun, Murphy? If that's what you're telling me, I'm going to tell you, you son of... Just calm down, relax. I'm not telling you to do anything. I'm not wagging my finger. I'm not judging anybody. All I am doing is, as an economist, I'm going to explain to you, if we were in Rothbard land, which many of you listening to this podcast desire, and so does Tom Woods and so do I, just let me walk you through that the institutions in that society would very quickly tend towards nonviolence. That's what I'm just trying to explain to you in this episode. And obviously, this has ramifications for the debate I'm going to have with Tom on the Contra Cruise. So let me first explain very quickly my understanding of how the legal system would operate in a Rothbardian society. So here, I'm just going to give you the abbreviated version of a lecture that I've given several times at Mises University that they call the market for security. Obviously, I'll link to that in the show notes page. You can get the longer version of it. But very briefly, it runs like this. Keep in mind, nobody in a Rothbardian society can be compelled to do something if they haven't already violated somebody's rights. And also going along with that, nobody can have a monopoly except one that arises voluntarily from market transactions. And so if there's a crime that occurs or someone claims there's a crime, the way I think things would naturally play out goes something like this. So let's say you think somebody broke into your house and took your television set. I mean, you come downstairs, your window's broken, your TV's gone, and you think the kid down the street took it. Now, you could just march down there, break into that house, and if you see your TV, take it out and then hold it up for your neighbors and say, see, I'm right. But that would be risky because, one, you know, even if you were right and the kid did steal it, maybe he hid it somewhere else. And just in general, that would look bad, right? That your neighbors would be uncomfortable seeing a grown man, assuming you're a grown man or a grown woman, if you're a grown woman, breaking into a house down the street and walking out with a TV. And you could say, oh, no, this is mine, but that's what a criminal might say too, right? So you can see how the community might strongly prefer, and they might even have codified in contractual arrangements when you bought the house in that subdivision, or, you know, or especially if you're just renting, your landlord might have you sign things saying, hey, even if you believe someone steals property from your apartment unit, you agree that you're not going to take matters into your own hands. You're going to go to qualified judges to resolve the matter. All right. So what the judge does in a free society is render his or her opinion on what the law says applied to your particular case. Right. And that, notice that's consistent even with the language we use in our own world, right? That what happens in a Supreme Court ruling, there's the majority opinion and the dissent, right? And the judges write their opinions. Okay, so even there, they have that humility. They're saying, you know, the, strictly speaking, even the way we talk, the judges aren't making the law. They're saying, or they're applying the law to a particular set of facts or circumstances. Okay. And obviously it gets perverted and we can talk about judicial activism, all that stuff. But in principle, that's how the legal system works. Okay. So that's what I think would happen in a free society. And you think your neighbor stole your TV set. So you go down there to a judge. And by the way, you wouldn't notice there isn't just one judge who's in charge of your zip code. Right, it's a free society. No one's got a monopoly, right? Just like there's not a mechanic that handles all the cars in your area, unless through past excellence, the mechanic is just so far and above all potential competitors that he or she enjoys a free market voluntary monopoly. But, you know, probably that's not going to happen in reality. Likewise, there will be several judges on the market offering their services, just like if you need a lawyer, there's not just one lawyer in the area. Right. And then also the judges would have different areas of expertise. If you're out jogging and you get physically assaulted by someone, you would go to a different judge than you'd go to if you think someone broke into your house and stole a television set. And certainly if, you know, you had a labor dispute with your employer, you'd go to a different type of judge who specializes in that area of the law. Okay. So here you would go to some reputable judge. I mean, well, the first thing you might do is you might just go to the kid's house and say, hey, give me my TV back. But, you know, let's say the kid says get lost. I don't know what you're talking about, old man. Then, you know, you take it to the legal authorities. And a reputable judge hears the case. You present evidence. The judge, you know, can inform the kid that he's being tried. And he can show up. If you know, notice they can't make the kid show up, right, because it's voluntary until he's been convicted. He's not a criminal. Right. So how could you use force on him? And then he can be convicted. Let's say bring print plan of it. Maybe you got video footage. Maybe somehow you demonstrate that your television set with its serial number is in that kid's house. Who knows? But let's say you present very compelling evidence and the judge rules that, yes, that kid down the street at such and such address took your television set. And so now I, the judge, in my opinion, believe that the restitution and necessary in this case is to return your television set plus whatever such and such ounces of gold as compensation for your inconvenience and so forth and covering your court costs, blah, blah, blah. And then that's the judge's opinion. And now, and so here, even in Rothbard land, and this is how I think it would start out originally, maybe you would go to a private recovery agency. And then they would actually go to the house where you think your TV is, and they would retrieve it. So notice, if you went to that agency first and just said, hey, that kid stole my television set, they wouldn't act. Right? That would be bad business. They would say no, because then the community might just think we're a bunch of paid thugs who go around stealing stuff. We're not going to go and break into somebody's house and retrieve a television set just on your say-so because you're paying us. Then that looks like we're just hired guns. So you need to show us documentation from a reputable judge that the community agrees, you know, is fair and honest, and then we'll go ahead and act on that. Okay, so here, for the purposes of the present podcast episode, I can't go into it in too much depth, but believe me, there's all sorts of considerations we can go into if you're worried about, well, gee, how would the community know it's a reputable judge? Why wouldn't they just sell their verdicts to the highest bidder? And you know, that logic, you can try applying that in other areas and see that it doesn't really hold water. Okay, that even just something goofy like sellers' ratings on Amazon or eBay. I mean, there's a market for stuff. You know who's reputable and who's not. And somebody who just consistently ripped off people, the community would know that pretty quickly. All right, so there's an objective fact of the matter. The community would be able to tell an honest judge from someone who's just a charlatan. And notice in the current system, dishonest judges who are corrupt and take money under the table and give biased rulings, they can survive because they have a monopoly position, or at least the government guarantees them cases over which they have jurisdiction. All right. Whereas, again, in a free society, the only judges who are getting cases brought to them are the ones that have a reputation for honesty, for being judicious, because that's the whole point. And notice also, too, this is a critical part that I don't see other anarcho-capitalist writers emphasizing, that in a lot of the standard canonical treatments, the defense agencies or private defense agencies, or PDAs as they're called, they sort of have the enforcement mechanism and the judicial rulings all rolled up in the same company. And I don't see why that would be the case. Like, just in terms of providing services, those two things are completely separate. And just in terms of the optics, I think that looks bad, right? I think you want them to be distinct. Okay. So I think in a free society, the enforcement agencies would be distinct from the judges, from the institutions that are issuing legal rulings. Okay, so now let's focus a little bit more on that element of the recovery agency, the agency that comes up and retrieves what the legal system has said is a stolen television set from the house down the street. Do you think they're going to go in there with chemical weapons, you know, like the way they did in Waco? You think that's going to happen? Do you think they're going to send stuff in there that's going to cause people's spines to seize up and, you know, it's going to kill babies or start a fire, and then they're going to roll in with tanks in order to get a television set? No, of course they're not going to do that. In fact, they will have every incentive to minimize property damage, to minimize noise, to not scare the other neighbors, and to get that TV set out without damaging the TV set and also without hurting the kid who presumably stole it. And, you know, we could dwell on this, but I don't think we need to. I mean, I hope everyone sees why that's obvious, that if you have a choice between different companies, and again, in a given region, there would be multiple competing agencies who would say, hey, if you have a pending or an outstanding legal ruling and you need to get your property recovered, then, you know, we're the people for the job. And so what would you do? Well, you'd compete on price, but also on not breaking stuff and not hurting people while you did it. And so instead of rolling in there with machine guns and chemical weapons, instead, you know, the agents involved would have a lot of body armor on. and non-lethal equipment, and they would probably just monitor the house and wait till it was empty. Or if for some reason people weren't leaving, they would come up with ways like, you know, tear gas or something to try to get them out of the house. And if there were a bunch of little kids there, they wouldn't send in tear gas. All right. They, you know, maybe they would cut the power or something. Who knows? But the point is, you can see how it would be really bad for business if they routinely broke stuff and hurt people in order just to get the property back. Okay. So that's one type of example. Another one is something like store security, right? So stores have to have security in place to prevent shoplifting or more serious attempts at robbery. And again, I think it's pretty obvious that even if initially the agencies were staffed by real tough guys who sought out that profession because they wanted to crack some heads and they wanted to be able to do it legally, that would quickly get weeded out, right? If you were a store and you hired some outside agency to provide security, and then they saw somebody shoplifting and he grabs some, you say your grocery store, and somebody grabs some steaks, puts them under his coat and starts sprinting for the door, and they pull out a gun and blow him away. Well, number one, that would terrify the other customers. If there's a shooting right in front of them, they wouldn't go back to your store, and the community in general would be outraged. And there'd be all sorts of exposés and people say, well, did you really need to shoot him because he was stealing steaks? And that would just be terrible for business. Okay. Even if you ran down and, you know, tackled the guy and broke his arm on the way down, that would also be bad for business, right? There'd be exposés. So I'm just saying, I think the state of the art professionalism in store security in a free society with open competition. And again, keep in mind how wealthy such a world would be. I mean, very quickly, it would be twice as wealthy per capita as our current society is. If it started out from where we are now, and then somehow everybody next week sees the wisdom of Rothbard and the state just falls away because everybody realizes it's goofy, right? Very quickly, we would be twice as wealthy per capita. And I think it would just keep going up and up. And so it wouldn't be that expensive to come up with techniques to, you know, the design of the store. Like maybe there's different checkpoints, sort of like airlocks or something, like in order to get out of the store. You know, it's real easy to do when everything's normal, but like when security sees something, they can press a button and there's kind of lockdown or something. So you can't get out very easily. You know, there could be all kinds of things where they could quickly contain the criminal, but not have to hurt them. Right? And I, to me, again, this isn't because they all read Tolstoy and the scales fall from their eyes and they say, oh, I can't believe it, that even defensive violence is a sin against God. No, I'm not talking about it. I'm just saying in terms of standard business profitability, clearly, if one firm is saying to all the shopkeepers, we will provide adequate security, here's our track record, you can see our history over the last 3 years from other stores in this area, look at how we've dealt with all these situations, look at their loss prevention, blah, 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 blah. And we have no fatalities. And this one time 2 years ago, yeah, a guy, he turned on us while we were bringing him down with our nets. And unfortunately, he cracked a rib and, you know, we paid his medical bills and da-da-da. You know, that kind of firm is going to get the contract rather than some other firm that says, oh yeah, well, you know, we're of the view that if you're a thief, then you're a scumbag and you need to have that beaten out of you. And we think that really actually customers would appreciate knowing that they shop in a store that doesn't tolerate crime. No, that's not going to last. The contract's going to go to the first firm. So I think that's pretty straightforward, and I don't need to dwell too much upon that. Hey, everybody, let's pause here to talk about music. As I was really hoping would happen, several people since I launched the podcast have contacted me and said, hey, Bob, what song is that on the opening there? Who sings that? It's me. So I must be a real musician if people didn't say, what the heck is that? Actually, I did have one guy say, I love the podcast, Bob, but that opening narrator and the music just is not at all right for your show. So I thought that was interesting. But he didn't say it's because it was bad. He just didn't like it. He thought it was too upbeat. Anyway, that's a song I did with Dan Hagen called Get to Higher Ground. I will put a link in at the show notes page. This is BobMurphyShow.com/19. Or you can just go to BobMurphyShow.com/hire, H-I-G-H-E-R, in order to get the full song. Okay, now let me talk a little bit about prison, right? So I think I probably have convinced you that, sure, most areas where there's a, you know, major company involved, that it's going to want to have internal security forces that on its own property, on the premises of the company, it doesn't want to have violence eked out upon a lawbreaker, right? That to the extent that we can contain the situation without using violence, that's just a win-win. That's better for, it's better for the criminal, of course, but it's also better for the company. It's just better for PR, the outside community, the customers, the employees. It's just, you know, it's unseemly to see somebody get hurt right in front of your face. So if we could just deal with the problem and neutralize it without causing bodily harm to anybody, even the aggressor, that would be better. And I think I've convinced you that in most day-to-day cases that are going to arise in normal life, especially when you realize how incomparably richer these people will be than we are right now, practically speaking, that's not sci-fi, that could easily happen. Again, the agencies, they could design the physical facilities and the teams could come in with body armor and, you know, foam sprays and with those bolo things that they throw, you know, around your ankles to trip you up. You know, there's all sorts of ways they could contain somebody without inflicting physical harm. Even somebody who has a gun, right? That the security forces could, again, be decked out in body armor and have, you know, big bulletproof shields and so forth that are 7 feet tall that they're holding in front of them. They could very quickly contain a situation without needing to shoot and let alone kill the person even who's armed with a weapon. Okay, but you say, all right, fair enough. And that even, by the way, even applies to things like banks, right? Like you could design a bank such that when there's a problem, boom, they press a button, the bank transforms, you know, total lockdown mode, and, you know, to ensure the safety of the personnel, and, you know, locks up all the cash or all the gold, let's say, and so forth, in ways that make it difficult for a criminal to get away with anything significant, but also it doesn't need to be the case that a bank robber needs to be taken out by a SWAT team, right? You can imagine all sorts of techniques. I mean, even nowadays, that doesn't need to happen very often, but I'm just saying you could really make it the case in a libertarian world that wouldn't need to happen. And I think that is the logical outcome of what market forces would, where they would push the agencies that were in charge of dealing with bank robberies, right? Because obviously banks would need to be prepared for that sort of thing. Okay, but what about in general, though? You say, okay, sure. So any particular institution, you know, any particular company, the crime that might be in progress on its own premises, sure, we can snuff that out, we can imagine. But what happens, Murphy, you know, with the convicted killer, you know, or the convicted bank robber? What, I mean, doesn't there have to be some voluntary Rothbardian ANCAP analog of the police to come and take these people and put them in handcuffs or something and drive them down to the prison and hold them there in a cage? Like, doesn't that need to happen? And there could be an analog of that even in a totally free society where everybody obeys property rights or respects property rights, or I should say the vast majority respect property rights, because obviously if everybody obeyed it, then we have no problem to even worry about. But even here, the way I think about this is not the way that I've seen it discussed in canonical treatments. So the first thing to realize is that in a Rothbardian society, there's no such thing as public land, right? Every piece of real estate is going to be owned privately. Now, it might be owned by some kind of mutual association, or it might be owned by some, whatever, conservation group or something that might keep a pond there for the public to enjoy. But strictly speaking, it would be private property, just with special rules allowing all sorts of people to use it under various circumstances. Okay, so every piece of land would be owned by someone or some group or some company that itself would be owned by people. So now that you've got that, okay. And so what I think would happen is if there were particular individuals who were convicted, again, according to the voluntary method I've described before of courts that in the community's opinion have proven themselves to be reputable, and these reputable judges have issued rulings, and let's say some guy is a convicted serial killer, right? That there have been people turning up dead here and there, and the various detective agencies involved, you know, it wouldn't just be the police. There'd be different people involved that are privately hired by insurance agencies or just, you know, the families of the victims out of their own on their own dime just because they want to figure out who the killer was. They figure out, they get various evidence, and reputable judges specializing in homicide, that area of the legal code, say, yes, we are quite sure that this individual has committed at least these 6 murders, and he's still at large. So what happens? I am saying whatever else you want to dream up in terms of what would be consistent with libertarian theory. And by the way, I'm not ruling any of that other stuff out. I'm not saying the other people in their discussions were wrong. I'm saying, though, clearly what could immediately happen that we know would not be a violation of anybody's rights is every property owner would clearly have the option to just say, hey, if you're a convicted serial killer at large, you're not allowed on my property. And so in particular, if this guy, Joe Smith, is walking around and he has been convicted of those 6 murders and he steps onto my land, I say, Joe Smith, get off my land. And if he doesn't, I can call the security forces that, you know, have the contract with my property, just, you know, as if there were some kid trying to set my building on fire or steal candy bars from me or whatever. Or if it's a house, you know, just in terms of anybody breaking into my house, and who do I have on speed dial or whatever the technology is at that point to come and get somebody off my property who's in the midst of committing a crime. And so that's, to me, what would happen. That would be the mechanism by which the convicted serial killer cannot associate with polite society. So no mall's going to let him in. No apartment's going to let him in. Depending on the contractual structure, he might not even be allowed in his own house, right? Like maybe when he bought into a subdivision, maybe he was agreeing to certain covenants, things like, oh, you can't play loud music past 3 a.m. You can't, you know, have really smelly compost heaps piled up in your backyard that your neighbors can smell and that attract animals and things like that. Oh, and if you get convicted of being a serial killer, you're not even allowed to come back into the neighborhood. You know, there could be clauses like that that you acknowledge ahead of time before you buy the house in that subdivision. Okay, so, or let's say that stuff wasn't spelled out. Well, still, if you're in your house, the power company could shut off power to you. They could say, yeah, part of our standard contracts, we have a clause in there. If you're convicted of being a serial killer, we're going to stop selling you electricity. Okay, so you can see how the community could very quickly and effectively isolate, to put an economic embargo, if you will, on certain pariahs who are living outside the law, who are outlaws. And again, it's, we don't have to quibble or, you know, tie ourselves up in knots about, well, gee, what are we allowed to do as punishment to the criminal? You know, are we allowed to boil them in oil, to skin them alive? You don't need it. It doesn't matter. Clearly, everybody's allowed to refrain from engaging in commerce with somebody. And in particular, a serial killer, you're certainly legally allowed to not sell him stuff. And so I think that's clearly what would happen. Whatever other mechanisms might kick in, clearly that would kick in. And so I'm saying for the really heinous criminals, the, you know, axe murderers, serial killers, multiple rapists, what have you, those sorts of people that the community in general is just going to be horrified by, just about everybody is going to say, get off my property. I'm not dealing with you. And so what happens to those people? Well, I'm saying, I think in that environment, then there would arise various oases, plural of oasis, that would welcome such outlaws. And now the motivations of these oases, or the people that construct them, could be varied. You know, there might be churches that feel bad for the, you know, those who have been shunned by society and have fallen through the cracks. And, you know, they might have very sympathetic views about what causes crime. There might be, you know, just all the other, again, nonprofit organizations that just have outreach. Or there might be for-profit institutions that just see a niche. And they say, hey, a lot of these people who are serial killers or rapists or whatever are still productive. They need to live somewhere. And so we will set up an institution that caters to them. And we will say to them, and so here's the thing. These various oases that are willing to deal with these outlaws, they would be competing for their business. Okay, so the way I'm looking at it, it's not that some institution or some agency goes around, grabs these people and throws them in a paddy wagon and drives them and puts them in a cage somewhere against their will. Rather, it's that the community largely says to these people, get off my land. And then the only places where they can end up, there's only like five or six places around that say to them, hey, why don't you come here? But then of those five or six places, they're competing for the patronage of the outlaws. They're saying to the outlaws, oh, no, don't go to those other four places. You want to come here because we'll treat you very well. Now, it's true. There's certain ground rules. When you show up at our front door, we're going to have our specially trained agents. You know, first of all, you're going to walk through a metal detector and we're going to make sure you're not carrying a weapon on you right now. And we're not even going to, get in the same room with you. We're not going to open like the inner door of our airlock, as it were, until we've convinced ourselves that you're unarmed. And then we're going to go ahead and, you know, give you a thorough inspection and, give you a change of clothes that you can't conceal weapons in. And we're going to have you in a very restricted movements, you know, in certain rooms, and you can only come out under certain times or whatever. But over time, you know, we'll have our psychologists on staff interviewing you. And over time, you might earn more privileges. But the thing is, you're going to work, right? You're paying us. It's like a hotel or an apartment that you're going to come live, and you got to work because you're going to have to pay us. That's why we're doing it if it's a for-profit institution. And you're not going to be doing something goofy like swinging an axe and breaking rocks or making license plates. If you're an engineer, you're going to be doing engineering tasks. If you're a programmer, you're going to be programming. If you're a novelist, you're going to write. All right. So that's the model I see. And last thing on this is I think the way you would get out of such an institution, so there's various ways of looking at it. So if you just had this outstanding monetary fine, then, you know, you just have to earn enough money to pay them. Or another element I could see in all of this to sort of buttress this framework that I'm describing for you guys is you would have fraternal organizations, perhaps, or maybe just more standardized insurance companies that would be effectively vouching for you, right? So the model here is automobile insurance, specifically the collision insurance, right? In order to drive on the road, you have to have an insurance company saying, if this driver causes damage to anybody else, we, the insurance company, will pay the damages. And so even though right now that's mandated by the state, I think in a free society, there probably would be analogs of that the owners of private roads would insist anybody who's going to operate a vehicle on our road has to carry an insurance policy of sufficient size offered by a reputable insurance company that covers, you know, any outside damage you cause. Or think about malpractice insurance. Right now in the real world, this isn't sci-fi, brain surgeons have to have insurance policy saying if they screw up and kill somebody on the table, that the malpractice insurance kicks in and pays off that liability. And, you know, free society, you could imagine that hospitals and, you know, other surgical centers would insist that their surgeons who are on staff carry such policies before letting them deal with the public. Okay, so likewise, I'm saying I could see apartment complexes saying, before we rent to you as a tenant, you have to have an insurance policy vouching for you that says if you commit a crime, then your outside insurance agency is the one that pays the legal damages of whatever some reputable judge says you owe because of your crime. And the way you then, you know, get out of prison, as it were, is you have to convince one of these reputable fraternal organizations, or let's just say insurance companies, to be willing to offer you a policy like that. And so that's, you know, so it's not that, oh, you killed somebody, so now you get 17 years in prison. And so for the first 17 years, you're a bad guy. And then, oop, once that's over, boom, now you're back to normal and you can come back. That's not the way it would work. It's that you, the various, you know, people around would not trust you if no agency was going to vouch for you. So they'd say, yeah, get off my land. And then it's only when some outside entity who's got skin in the game, right? Because they don't want to vouch for you if you're going to go kill people again, because then they have to pay for it, right? But on the other hand, if you really are reformed and rehabilitated, you know, some guy comes home, he sees his wife in bed with his best friend, he goes nuts and kills them both, you know, and the psychologist is talking to him for the next 8 years, and he's generated enough money, and he's paid the estates of the victims and so forth. Maybe the psychologist, working in conjunction with these outside insurance agencies, say, yeah, we really think he learned his lesson. It was a, you know, crime of passion. He's not going to do that again. He's perfectly safe. And I think, you know, if you allow him to start paying you premiums again, you can safely offer him a policy so that he can get reintroduced into society at large. And, and again, the reason the other landowners are letting him on their property is that he's been vouched for by some reputable third party. All right. So that's the kind of framework I have in mind. So notice there too, again, violence isn't really necessary. That you can imagine. So for one thing is these oases, these like rehabilitation centers or whatever you want to call them, they really would be rehabilitation centers. They wouldn't just be a sick euphemism the way it is now. And they certainly would not have sadistic guards that beat people up. And they also wouldn't have settings that allow other inmates to do horrible things to each other. And I don't need to elaborate on that, but you know what I'm talking about. Okay, so just you see how the need for violence to contain crime in this system I'm describing goes virtually to zero. And also, let me just mention that the big thing here is the waste of a punitive legal system. So obviously, the kind of way that my society deals with criminals versus the way the society Tom Woods is going to have in mind deals with criminals, both of those are going to be way, 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 way better than the current system. All right. So I'm not trying to say that the vision that Tom's going to be presenting on the cruise is going to be some sadistic thing, you know, where prisoners are boiled in oil. But nonetheless, I'm saying if he's in favor of defensive violence, then I'm pointing out that, you know, that's wasteful anytime that happens. That, let's say somebody kills somebody. Let me just put it this way. Let's say somebody kills somebody. I'm fine, and I think it's correct, that under standard libertarian theory, somebody has the right to kill the killer, right? That, in other words, it would not be another crime if somebody kills that first murderer. Now, it gets a little bit murky as to who has that right. Okay, so it's easier. Why don't we back up? Jim walks up to Paul and punches him in the arm. I think it's pretty clear cut to say in standard libertarian theory that Paul has the right to punch Jim in the arm back. Now, it's not certain because, again, it's libertarian theory ideally just talks about, and it's very solid when it comes to voluntary transactions. It's a little bit ad hoc once you depart from that and to say, well, what if somebody violates it and doesn't do something, you know, does something involuntary? What then can you do in response? It's not clear, right? Because you don't want to say, oh, if Jim punches Paul in the arm, then Paul can take out an axe and cut Jim's head off. That seems like that would be a crime too. So Rothbard developed and Walter Block codified what was called two teeth for a tooth. The idea being, hey, somebody steals my TV. First of all, I get my TV back. And then I get to do to that person what he did to me. So I can steal his TV also. So technically, I'm getting two TVs for one TV. And so harkening back to the a tooth for a tooth from the Mosaic Law, that's been codified as saying a two teeth for a tooth retribution principle. All right. So there's problems with that too. I mean, I don't want to get too weird here on the podcast, but I mean, like, if somebody beats you up, it's not obvious you get to beat them up twice, because, you know, notice how that doesn't really fit. It's not that you're getting back your own bodily integrity upon the first beating, and then the second one is like you doing to him what he did to you. I mean, it's, you know, you beating that guy up doesn't make you better off the way taking a TV does. So even there, it gets pretty murky very fast. But what I'm getting at is violent retribution per se, or just punishment in general, doesn't really do anything for the original victim. All right. So yes, if somebody kills somebody, I'm fine if somebody wants to say standard libertarian theory would allow that person to be killed in response. But that killing per se doesn't bring back the original victim to life. It doesn't help the relatives of the murder victim, except insofar as, you know, they might get psychological closure, or it might satisfy, you know, some urge for revenge. And you know, I don't, maybe it would, maybe it wouldn't. And some people, you know, I've seen different accounts, and some people saying it does help with closure, and other people saying, no, that actually just made me feel worse. And, you know, we can get into that. But instead, I think a system where the convicted murderer, first of all, his insurance company pays $1 million to the victims, or, you know, to the estate of the victim, that makes a lot more sense. And then he has to get right with the insurance company. And so rather than killing the murderer, now the murderer just is basically working a lot and generating income to help pay his debt to society, if you will. So I think in terms of just sheer pragmatism, that clearly is more productive. And I think possibly it's better in terms of rehabilitation, right? So I think that's partly why the modern system doesn't work, that you commit a crime and then you go into prison where you're victimized further and you see how corrupt the cops are, and you're in there and you see other people coming and going who did worse stuff than you. I mean, that doesn't make you better off. Or you're rubbing shoulders with, you know, somebody does a relatively minor crime and then gets thrown in a cage with some guy who's a much worse criminal. Either the guy victimizes him, so that's bad, or, you know, he teaches him stuff like, oh, yeah, I'm a bank robber. Here, let me show you how it works. And when we get out of here, you know, I got another job lined up, and why don't you join me? You know, so there's all kinds of crazy stuff where the modern penal system not only fails to minimize crime or reduce crime, it actually promotes it. And so I'm saying moving away from a punitive, retributive system to a compensation system, a nonviolent compensation system, to me, I think is much more productive and rehabilitative, if that's a word, than one that uses violence. So again, the difference between what I'm saying and what Tom's going to be proposing is much smaller than either of our visions compared to the status quo. But still, I'm saying if you the sense in which a system that uses only defensive violence is more productive than one that allows offensive violence, I'm saying by the same token, then just think it through. There are some respects in which clearly the system that doesn't use even defensive violence is going to be more efficient, just in a cold-blooded sense. Because again, and here again, here's what it comes down to. When somebody is a criminal, inflicting violence on that person or putting them in a cage, that per se, those actions, those punishments per se don't help anybody, except possibly for their deterrence value. If instead you replace those with fines, monetary fines, then that's still punishing the person, right? You don't want, it's just like, oh yeah, I don't want to have to spend 5 years in a cage. Well, likewise, I don't want to pay someone $300,000 as a fine. So those are both bad things to happen to the lawbreaker. But the difference is me spending 5 years in a cage doesn't help anybody else. Whereas if I have to spend $300,000 on a fine, yeah, I'm down $300,000. That sucks. But there's someone who gained the $300,000, so that's good. So that's, again, the essential difference between a criminal justice system based on punishing people either violently or by restricting their freedom versus one that largely focuses on financial restitution. Folks, let's pause for a moment to talk about the Contra Cruise. That's right, the Contra Cruise, the libertarian event of the year. This year, 2019, the dates are July 5th through 12th. We're departing from Seattle, Washington. We're going to hit some Alaska ports, including a glacier. And we're also going to hit Victoria in British Columbia. I hear that this particular itinerary is just gorgeous. I've seen some of the pictures of it. The cruise liner itself is a good one. It's going to be great, but it's not just the cruise. It's the fact that it's the Contra Cruise, right? So we're going to have Brad and Deidre Berzer. You've probably heard them on Tom Woods' show. And Gene Epstein's going to be there as well. Not only is he going to give a talk and probably share all kinds of naughty anecdotes after hours with you guys, but he's also going to moderate the debate between me and Tom Woods. Now, if you haven't noticed, Tom's pretty competitive, and I'm no slouch myself. If you've seen on Twitter, it's cute. He's so cute. He's trying to punch me, and he swings and misses. You give it to him. Really, it's going to be a great debate. You're not going to want to miss it. Also, there's music. We're going to have Dan Hagen back, Tatiana Moroz, my dad, Pat Murphy. The Pat Murphy, just to clarify, is going to be there. It's going to be phenomenal. In fact, in case you're still on the fence, you're like, you know what, but it's in your interest, Bob, to promote this thing. I want to hear some unbiased commentary from somebody I respect who's been on it before. Okay, here's an excerpt of Tom Woods talking to Naomi Brockwell. Many of you know who she is. She was a guest on last year's Contra Cruise. Tom had her on his show. The cruise naturally came up, and listen to what she had to say. We did not tell her to say this. She volunteered this. Play the clip, guys.
Naomi, welcome back.
Thank you so much for having me.
Total pleasure to have you on the Contra Cruise. We had such a great time, and your quiz show that you did with us was such an amazing hit. Even though I lost miserably, I've never enjoyed myself more losing miserably.
You lost valiantly.
That's right.
You lost with grace and style and pizzazz. No, it was super, super fun. I'm so pleased that I got to host it on the cruise, which was the best event I've ever been to in my life. I have to just go out there and say it was so much fun.
And there you have it. Do you want to skip this thing? Are you kidding me? Come on. Come on, join us. The Contra Cruise. Go to ContraCruise.com for all the details. Hope to see you there. Let me take a few minutes now to talk about something that at first might seem like it's coming out of left field, but it actually does augment the basic framework that I've been discussing with you guys, and it has to do with blackmail. And the reason this is on my mind is that, coincidentally enough, as I was thinking through getting ready for this episode that I'm recording here and sharing with you guys, this issue of legalized blackmail all of a sudden became a hot topic again on the free market economists' blogosphere. And the reason is, of course, the Jeff Bezos, him saying that the National Enquirer was trying to blackmail him with photos about, you know, the affair he was having. And so Tyler Cowen had an article where he was going over, you know, hey, why is it that blackmail is illegal? And he mentioned in passing that some libertarians actually make a, at least superficially, compelling case for why blackmail should be legal. And he linked to a Law Review article from the 1980s by Walter Block and David Gordon. And so I wrote a piece for Mises.org summarizing this and giving a longer treatment of what I'm going to just boil down here for you guys right now. And of course, I'll link to it at bobmurphyshow.com/19 if you want to see the longer treatment. But for right now, let me just quickly summarize the issues and then I'll show you how it plugs into what we've been talking about. So the first thing that, and let me be clear, I agree with Walter Block and David Gordon. I don't think blackmail should be illegal. And so right off the bat, let's just clarify our terms. sometimes people use the word blackmail and extortion interchangeably, but that's not the way Block and Gordon are using it. So in their usage, which I think is more useful because those terms mean different things to the public, even though the meanings sometimes overlap. Extortion is like if I go up to a storekeeper and say, hey, be a shame if something were to happen to your business here. If you pay me $100 a week, you know, nothing happens or whatever the numbers are. And I would do a better Italian accent if I were really going to try to shake somebody down. Okay, so that's what extortion is. It's where you're exacting payment or maybe some other form of compensation from somebody with an implicit or even explicit threat to do something that itself is a violation of their rights, like beating them up or setting their store on fire, smashing windows, whatever. In contrast, blackmail in its pure form is you can call it a threat. That's fine. I don't have a problem with that. But it's threatening to do something that you have every right to do. Right. So it's like coming up to somebody and saying, hey, I saw you cheating on your wife yesterday. It would be a shame if someone were to tell her that you're cheating on her. But, you know, you pay me $1,000 and this problem goes away. I didn't see a thing. Right. So that is a blackmail threat. It's not extortion the way Block and Gordon are using the terms. And they're going to say, you know, you could be a jerk just in general, in case you're not familiar with this type of argument. Walter Block, of course, epitomizes it in his famous book, Defending the Undefendable. The approach here is to say, look, just because we're saying something should be legal, we're not saying the people who engage in that practice are morally upright or people we should applaud. We're just saying they're not violating rights, and so therefore it would itself be a crime or unjust for us to use force to stop them from doing an activity that itself does not violate anybody's rights. That's the essence of libertarianism and the non-aggression principle. Okay, so back to the examples we were dealing with. If I see somebody cheating on his wife and I go and tell her, I haven't committed a crime. I haven't violated anybody's rights by sharing information with her. On the other hand, if I refrain from telling her that, that also is not a violation of anybody's rights. So I have the perfect legal right to either share this information with her or to refrain from doing so. And so how can it be that if I go up to the husband, the philanderer, and say, hey, if you pay me a certain amount of money, that will affect which of these two perfectly legal, permissible things I can do, why then does it become a crime? If you really want to push it, another way of seeing it is, or just to see the awkwardness of legal prohibitions on blackmail, I believe if somehow the husband, like let's say he's, you know, with his mistress and he looks up and he sees me walking by and he sees me kind of recognize him and I see the mistress and the fact that they're holding hands and drinking wine or whatever in a romantic setting, and I realize he's cheating on his wife, you know, and he can tell by my face that I put two and two together and I kind of just, and I start walking away hurriedly. And then let's say he chases me down and he says, hey, look at, I know this looks bad and everything, but you know, geez, we got kids and you know, I'm just going to be frank with you, man. I'm really hoping you do the right thing here. And it's a one-time slip. And you know, I always think that you could use a nice suit and here's $500. Why don't you go get yourself a nice suit? And he walks away. I don't think he just broke any laws, right? That, you know, I'm not a politician or something. You know, he's not bribing a public official. I'm pretty sure it would be legal for him to do that. And I think it would also be legal for me to take the money he just put into my hands and put it in my pocket and keep walking and then not say anything to his wife. I think all that would be legal in the real world right now. I'm not talking about, you know, Rothbard land. I'm saying even right now with the current legal prohibitions against blackmail. So then isn't it kind of weird where if we just flip it and I say to him later after, you know, the mistress leaves and I catch him later and I say, hey, by the way, I saw what happened and geez, I wish I could, you know, I could use a new suit. It'd be a shame if your wife found out that, and I just right there broke the law. Isn't that kind of weird? So anyway, that's the kind of thing where if you're thinking of it as an armchair libertarian and just reasoning from a priori principles, that's the sense in which it seems like blackmail shouldn't be illegal. Like it's hard to defend its illegality. in terms of rights theory. Okay. So that's the standard argument in terms of just arguing from pure philosophy, if you will. And then what's interesting, though, is as an economist, when you start thinking it through, as in so many other areas, it seems that the prohibition on blackmail, even though it's common sense and clearly that's going to be a good thing, right? Because it'll salvage reputations and you won't have snooping reporters and all this stuff. It's actually not so obvious once you start thinking about it that there might be unintended bad consequences from the prohibition, or going the other way, if we were to legalize blackmail, even though probably most people recoil in horror at that suggestion and think that's a crazy idea. Well, actually, no, there's a lot of benefits that would flow from it. So let me just outline those. So the first thing to keep in mind is, for some reason, and in this the blogosphere discussion, Scott Sumner, an economist associated with the Mercatus Center, he came out strongly against legalizing it. So he thinks that people like Block and Gordon and David R. Henderson also jumped in on their side. Robin Hanson also is in favor of legalizing it. So Sumner thinks these guys are all wrong. And one of his main arguments was to say, you know, I think people value their privacy and they don't want their reputations smeared. And so that's why I, Scott Sumner, think it makes sense that we as a society have blackmail being illegal. And to me, prima facie, that gets things exactly backwards. That would be like saying, well, you know, I value being able to get from point A to point B. I value transportation, and that's why I think we should ban cars. Right? You see how that, like, just complete nonsense? By the same token, what the option of blackmail does, it gives the target the option of protecting his reputation, right? Because if he doesn't pay the blackmailer, that's when the blackmailer says, okay, and releases the, you know, embarrassing or incriminating information or photos or whatever. Okay, so blackmail per se, the actual act of approaching someone and giving them an offer and saying, hey, I will refrain from sharing this information with the public if you pay me enough, that contains leaks. Okay, now, in fairness to Scott, what he has in mind is that, oh, wait a minute, knowing that that payday is there at the end of the tunnel, it's going to incentivize people to go dig up more dirt than they otherwise would have. But my, you know, first point is just to say right now there's plenty of tabloid newspapers that thrive on and websites now too that thrive on publicizing embarrassing stuff about rich celebrities or politicians or whatever. Okay, so it's not like right now because blackmail is illegal, nobody has any gossip spread about them. And in fact, if it's somebody famous and where the rumors are marketable, it's the opposite where if the National Enquirer or somebody, you know, if they get their hands on something juicy that would be titillating to the general public, but very embarrassing or otherwise harmful to particular individuals, right now it's those particular individuals have no ability to contain the information, even if they would be perfectly happy to pay whatever, $50,000 to make this thing go away. They don't have that option. It's literally illegal for the entity possessing the information to give them a chance to bury it. They can't even do that. They're breaking the law technically. So also too, just like prohibition on drugs traffic, it's not like blackmail doesn't occur just because the government made it illegal, right? So let's also keep that in mind that we're not really arguing about, do I want to live in a society where blackmail exists? Yes or no. We're arguing, do we want to live in a society where blackmail occurs out in the open with companies that have enforceable contracts and can get name brand recognition and the public can see, you know, like a potential blackmail target can know, well, this company actually, if I do pay them, I know they're actually going to keep their word. Whereas right now, people still get blackmailed all the time, even though it's technically illegal, because this is, it's technically, it's a victimless crime, right? That the reason blackmail works is that the person who's paying the money would rather pay the money than have the secret divulged. That's why they agree to do it, right? So again, we're distinguishing blackmail from actual extortion or robbery. The blackmailer is not sticking a gun in the belly of the person saying, give me some money. Rather, he's saying, it's up to you. Right now, I have this damaging information I'm going to release unless you pay me enough not to. And so if the blackmailee elects to pay the money, well, then that demonstrates that he prefers the secret being kept over maintaining that cash in his wallet. So again, that's the sense in which blackmail is a victimless crime, strictly speaking. And so that's also why blackmail occurs so much, even though it's illegal, because the person being blackmailed is not going to go call the cops, because the whole point is he doesn't want anybody to know about this secret. So he's going to keep his mouth shut. Okay. So just to finish that train of thought, again, the choice is not, do we want to live in a world with or without blackmail? Just like the choice is not, do we want to live in a world with or without heroin? That's not a choice available to us. Rather, it's, do we want people getting heroin through legal mechanisms where there's name brand companies selling the product and ensuring its purity and so forth? Or do we want junkies out committing crimes in order to steal and, you know, in order to raise the money to get these really overpriced products that they don't even know the quality of, that could be full of impurities and empowering gangs and all the other stuff that goes along with the drug war? Okay, so real quickly here, just to give a specific application, in a mature blackmail industry, there would be companies with, again, that had established brand name reputation, just like in today's world, something like WikiLeaks, right? There are a lot of people who do not agree with what WikiLeaks does. They question the motives of Assange, and especially, you know, with the 2016 election now, there's lots of people who, for obvious reasons, think that it's biased. But nobody, to my knowledge, has ever credibly shown that anything released by WikiLeaks is false. Okay, so everybody tacitly, or if they're fans of WikiLeaks, explicitly points out and agrees that, yes, the material that is released in these WikiLeaks dumps is correct. It's accurate. And the issue is just, well, what are the motivations? Why is it doing it? And maybe it's choosing to sit on other stuff. But nobody's disputing that the stuff released by WikiLeaks is accurate. And so I'm saying, but the same token, in a mature, legalized blackmail industry, in a free society like we're talking about, I think market forces would be such that certain companies would arise with a stellar reputation, insofar as everybody would know, yeah, when they release gossip about somebody or they release a photo of somebody in an embarrassing situation or whatever, it's always accurate, right? Like, there's never been a proven case where they say, oh, so-and-so's cheating on his wife, and it turned out he really wasn't. You know, that's the name brand reputation they would build up for themselves, because that would give them a lot of leverage. So then when they would approach somebody with money and say, hey, we've got this dirt on you, we can release it to the public, or if you pay us such and such, we'll keep it quiet, the target of that offer would know that, geez, the public's really going to believe this because these guys are credible. They have a reputation. They vet the material that's brought to them by, you know, tipsters in the public and, you know, people who call in leads and whatever. And so the company would have more leverage and thereby would be able to charge more to sit on it. Also, how would the company get its material in the first place? Well, it would pay bounties for information that its own internal audits verified. You know, in other words, if somebody just went in there and told some crazy story that didn't fit the facts and was clearly made up, they wouldn't pay you for that. But if somebody goes in and tells something, or, you know, gives a photo or whatever, and the internal audits say, yep, this looks authentic, well, then they would give certain monetary rewards for that because they could use it to go get their revenue. That's the business model. How would something like that work, and why might it be socially beneficial? Why might a world with that sort of company in it be better than the current system where that thing is illegal? I thought of a great example. Let's consider the case of the comedian Louis C.K. So I think most of you probably are vaguely aware, at least, of what the allegations were. And he even admitted it, so I guess we could stop calling them allegations. Because this is a family-friendly podcast, I won't be very explicit about what it was, but just so I'm not totally losing it. What happened apparently was he would be in his hotel room, he'd be at an event, and then take female either staff members or other comedians back to his hotel room, and he would get their permission to then do something that he should not have been doing. How's that? Okay, and so you can go Google if you don't have no idea what I'm talking about. Okay, so he maintains, and I don't think it has ever been shown that this isn't true, but his official story when he was, you know, given his public apologies and whatever, was to say he would always get consent. Okay, so this is not a crime. I mean, let's just stipulate for the sake of argument that that's true, right? I mean, I didn't hire a private detective myself, but I have never seen anything of any of the people complaining about it after the fact who said this is what he did to me. I haven't seen anybody say that he actually committed a crime. It was just always he did something that was wildly inappropriate, but technically he asked before he did it and got consent. And, you know, in some cases, I think they thought he was kidding or something, but technically he said, do you care if I do this? And they said, go ahead. And then he did it. They couldn't believe it and left the room. Okay, so that's the kind of situation we're dealing with. So that was quiet for years. Now, I didn't go. I should have looked up to say exactly how long. But in other words, there were women who knew that, yeah, Louis C.K. did this to me as he rose and became this really famous comedian and, you know, got rich and everything. And then only years later did they finally tell their story publicly. And then, you know, once a few of them came forward, then more did and so forth. And then, you know, the huge scandal broke. He had to just leave the public eye for, I don't know, a year or so. And then now was coming back and, you know, half the public likes it and half the public is outraged and thinks he should never work again. And okay, all that stuff. So what I'm saying is, imagine if we had had the type of system in place that I just described a minute ago. Well, then early on, as soon as Louis C.K. at least rose to prominence such that it would be very economically painful for him to have that secret told, those first few women that he did that stuff to, they could have gone to one of these companies and, you know, shared their story. And then the company, you know, could have verified it and checked the story against the available facts and whatever. And assuming they said, yep, this looks very plausible. They could approach Louis C.K. and say, look, we've got this very credible allegations against you. So tell you what, you know, you can agree this would ruin your public image if this came out. So you pay us $200,000 a year. And for every year, you know, that this thing stays quiet, you just keep paying us. Obviously, if it ever breaks, if, you know, if the story ever becomes public, we'll refund your money for that year. Okay, we're not going to refund you for previous years, but, you know, if you've just given us a check and then the story breaks the following week, we'll refund, you know, your money for that year. But, you know, you're, in other words, you're paying us $200,000 a year for the continued silence on this. And then the deal they could have with those women who brought them the story would be, you know, maybe they would give them 50% or whatever, however the market prices would break, shake out. And likewise with those women, they would say, you know, you're going to keep getting paid so long as nobody ever hears about this. But keep in mind, if this story ever goes public, then you stop getting the payments from us too, right? So you're incentivizing the complainants to also keep their mouths shut because they realize then, you know, the money they're getting, this flow of revenue disappears if, you know, they tell too many people privately. You know, they could say, no, don't tell anybody because, you know, I'm getting these checks every year. But if they tell too many people like that and such that somebody breaks the story and then the public finds out, well, then boom, gravy train's over. Okay, so that's the way that kind of a system would work. And I know a lot of people would recoil in horror at that. It's, oh, so rich people could just go around and do whatever they want and just buy off their victims. Okay, so number one, that's kind of what happens right now anyway, right? There's a lot of stuff like that already. But number two, it's not literally the same thing. In the system I'm talking about, women or other people, it doesn't have to be women, you can generalize the kind of scenarios we mean, but people who are placed in awkward positions, mistreated, let's say, by powerful people, they have a lot of reasons to not come forward. And I think it would be much better in an anarcho-capitalist world because the legal system would be run by market forces and whatever. The press, I think, would have more accountability than they do right now. But still, you know, like these women in the real world today who came forward against Louis C.K., they've had horrible things said to them over social. You know, they've been doxxed and blah, blah, blah. You know, people calling them bad names that you call women when you want to hurt their feelings. And you get the idea. Okay. And so, in other words, it was very difficult for them. They could have just kept their mouth shut, but they felt, you know, some of them felt like, well, we got to speak out or something. Or I don't know the exact story. Maybe they told somebody who then told some newspaper. And, you know, once a reporter contacted them, they didn't want to lie about it. I don't know exactly why was it quiet for so long and then became public. I don't remember the details of that. But my point is, it was no picnic for these women to now all of a sudden also be part of the national conversation. And so I'm saying that's one huge benefit of the system I just sketched for you guys, is that people with credible accusations against powerful or rich people could share them in a private thing, where by its very nature, it only works if it's kept secret. Okay, so that's what distinguishes this mechanism from going to the police. And then again, there's not one agency called the police in the society we talked about. But again, the difference between what I'm saying here in this little digression versus what I was sketching for you earlier is that earlier, the point is the complainant wants the public to know that what this person did, to know this person's a lawbreaker, because you're going to then go to the enforcement agencies to try to get some restitution, and you need the public to realize that what you're doing is legitimate. Like, you're going to go retrieve the TV, the company that's going to have the strong guys with body armor to go do that. They need to be able to prove to the community, hey, we're not criminals, we're just retrieving stolen property. So they need a public trial and, you know, judicial opinion to back them up, so the community doesn't think that there's theft occurring in broad daylight. In contrast, this whole blackmail industry, and they would probably use euphemisms, right? Like, the company might be, in the Mises article, I imagine the company would be called The Truth Hurts Incorporated or something like that. Okay, so in other words, they would be focusing on the fact that, hey, this gossip, this dirt is true. Hey, don't look at us. We're not the bad guys. We're just the messengers. It's these, you know, scumbag philanderers or guys who, you know, lied and have 16 girlfriends, or, you know, you get the idea. So the whole nature of that would be to maintain secrecy. And so yes, you might be upset that the public doesn't learn about the particular transgressors. But on the flip side, a lot of people would be willing to come forward who otherwise would just keep their mouths shut and say, you know what, it's going to be a circus, and this guy's powerful, he's going to have a lot of defenders, you know, he's popular. You know, think about Bill Cosby, that kind of stuff too. You know, it might have been a separate thing, whereas, you know, he was doing actual criminal things, whereas, again, Louis C.K., to my knowledge, nobody has even credibly accused him of doing something criminal. It's just really creepy and, ugh, that's weird, Louis, what are you doing? Okay, so it would, again, protect the women who are bringing these complaints. Also, it gives them compensation. Okay, I don't believe right now. So yes, Louis C.K. took a financial hit, but that didn't correspond to payments into the pockets of the women that he did that stuff to, as far as I know. I don't think he's given them any. Certainly, he's not legally obliged to. Maybe, you know, he may have, for all I know, but it's a token of goodwill, but I don't know that he has. All right, so the complainants get a lot of grief under the current system and no payment, whereas the system I'm sketching, nobody trashes their reputation and they get paid. Okay, so that's a benefit, right? That's two things that are better in the system I've just sketched out than in the status quo. And then also notice, in that world, it would have stopped Louis earlier, right? Because as soon as he became wealthy enough that it would even be worthwhile to try to shake him down, if that's the pejorative language you want to use, then he would have gotten feedback. He would have realized, oh, geez, that stuff I did for the last 3 years, it's starting to cost me now financially. Like, quite explicitly, he would know. Whereas in the real world, it was just, you know, he had that lingering in the back of his mind and was probably worried and thinking, geez, I wonder if that's ever going to catch up with me. But technically, you know, he wasn't getting an explicit slap on the wrist or any kind of penalty. Okay, so that's another benefit of what I'm saying, is people would face consequences for their socially aberrant behavior sooner rather than later. And so presumably Louis C.K. in this alternative universe I'm describing would have stopped doing that stuff earlier. So maybe there would have been some women who got spared that altogether in the alternative universe, because the earlier ones that he did that to would have complained, and, you know, he would have had to start effectively paying them off and, you know, giving a cut to the company and middleman earlier. And he just would have stopped doing that. Said, okay, yeah, I got to stop. That's crazy. You know, I shouldn't be doing that anyway. And look at, this is costing me money. I got to stop doing that. Okay. So that's, you can see how it's arguably a much better system than what we have right now, for all those different reasons. Also too, you know, and here we can get into various views of psychology and guilt and whatever, but I'm open to the idea that a world like that, where when people slip up and do something really, again, not criminal, but something that would really ruin their career, or just, you know, their existing circle of friends would disown them or whatever, you know, that kind of a thing. It's technically not illegal, so not a crime, but just really awkward socially, that kind of stuff, that, yep, it gets nipped in the bud, and then they can be relatively sure, or at least they can take much stronger measures in that world that I'm describing to contain it. And so they don't have to worry as much that the secret's going to get out. Okay. Whereas, you know, so they can more move on with their lives and perhaps feel like, you know, that they've paid the penalty for it, and then they can move on. All right. So again, I'm not putting too much weight on this last little tidbit that I'm talking about, but I am just mentioning it, that I think somebody who really studied this could make a plausible case that people who have a slip up and do something stupid, especially like if they were drinking or something, this would allow them to kind of move on with their lives and not do it again. Whereas in a world where you wouldn't have, because, you know, basically what's happening is you're getting immediate negative feedback. You are getting fined, in quotation marks, right away for doing something, you know, that's socially inappropriate, let's say. Now, last thing I'll mention, and again, you can go read the stuff that I'll link to at bobmurphyshow.com/19 on this. When Scott Sumner, for example, was complaining, his point was that the things that are socially inappropriate or that the public would punish you for are not necessarily things that Scott Sumner agrees are bad, right? So like in the 1950s, if somebody was a homosexual, you know, that was a secret, and somebody who found out about it could be blackmailing the person because, geez, if the community at large realized I was in the closet, then, you know, my career would be over or whatever. And so Scott thinks, you know, the public has very hypocritical and puritanical and, you know, goofy and disgusting in certain aspects views on sex and whatever. And so Scott thinks, why would I want to arm an industry to go out and extract money from people on the basis of the community's silly preferences or obnoxious preferences, or odious, I should say. That's probably a better word for where Sumner's coming from. And, you know, okay, fine. But, you know, as economists, again, I don't want to put too much weight on this, but I'm just pointing out this is like a great mechanism for internalizing externalities. Okay, so I'll just mention that. I won't spend too much time on this because it's kind of a tangential point. But as economists, normally we say stuff like, oh, well, the market's really good. Hey, if people want to smoke cigarettes, you know, we have a free market, and then resources get allocated, and the profit and loss system ensures that a certain amount of farmland is set aside for growing tobacco. And you can object to that as an outsider and look at that system and wag your finger and say, that's not good. Smoking is bad. And I disagree with people's preferences, but hey, their preferences are what they are, and the market caters to that. And given what people's preferences are, this is, you know, a certain amount of resources should flow into land being set aside for growing tobacco and making cigarettes. Okay, so likewise, the community has certain views on infidelity or smoking, or, you know, like going the other way. Like if some guy said he quit smoking and he really didn't, well, then maybe, you know, he'd be having people charge blackmail fees. Or that swimmer, you know, the photo of him hitting the bong. And so, yeah, that's a little bit hypocritical. Like, I'm sure, in other words, a lot of people have smoked marijuana in the United States, and they certainly didn't win gold medals shortly thereafter. So it's kind of goofy that he's being punished. You know what I mean? So I get where Sumner's coming from. But on the other hand, there are plenty of things where there's so-called market failure, where this is a nice system to kind of harness the social approval or disapproval and effectively, quote, fine somebody for doing something that the community really disapproves of. Okay, so, you know, again, I don't want to put too much weight on this, but I just throw that out there, that it's, before we just quickly dismiss this, like, oh, blackmail, that's crazy, and only a jerk would do that, so therefore it's wrong. No, there's actually, if you think through the ramifications of, you know, step 3, 4, 5, and 6, if you legalized it, and what would happen and how would society evolve, it's actually pretty interesting. And also, I guess the last thing I'll say on that, I think precisely by bringing in the, quote, rationality of market prices, you might make society's preferences and judgments and social norms a little bit more, let's say, rational, for lack of a better term. So, for example, if, the president, whether it's Bill Clinton or Donald Trump, depending on which political party you're in, gets caught cheating on his wife, I think it would be more difficult for hypocrites to wag their finger and to be denouncing him at cocktail parties and whatever, or writing articles, if they were at that moment quietly paying off, you know, some blackmail company because they had dirt on them about how they were cheating on their wives. You see what I mean? So you could say, I don't know, people are still hypocrites, Bob. And a lot of people, like whatever, Newt Gingrich and other Republicans, were complaining about Bill Clinton with Monica Lewinsky when they themselves were cheating on their wives. And so they were hypocrites and they were doing it. And but again, I think they might be less likely to do that. They might keep their mouths shut or be less vocal in their denunciations if they were, I mean, for no other reason than they know somebody knows about what they're doing, right? Whereas I think until it's been publicized, right? In other words, the people who right now are hypocrites and railing against or standing up for family values when they're actually philanderers or seeing prostitutes or whatever on the side, all these cases of these, you know, these famous hypocrites, before they've been caught, technically nobody knows about it. And so they might think they can get away with it. Whereas in a world where more people are financially motivated to go snooping around and dig up dirt on people, and then, you know, so it's, again, it's not that everybody's going to have their reputations trashed. On the contrary, fewer people will have their reputations trashed because now there's a better mechanism in place for them to protect their reputations by paying off the people with dirt, but more dirt will be found. Okay. And so it's, I'm saying that it's not obvious to me that that will just exacerbate the problems with society and the hypocrisy. I could see it going the other way, that there'll be less hypocrisy because people will have been caught themselves, but they won't be ruined. It'll just be privately on the side. Someone will be like, actually, you know, you've been cheating on your wife. We've got the evidence right here. And, but, you know, you pay us $2,000 a month and no one needs to know about it. So maybe that person now will not be so quick to denounce others. Okay. So anyway, that's a long digression. But the reason I thought it worthwhile to get into it was because it shows the, I think it augments the basic framework that I just laid out for you guys before. And so you can see, you know, you have the standard thing, the lectures I've been given for years about how a private legal system and enforcement agencies would work. And just recently now with this blackmail stuff, that I really fully comprehend the potential social benefits of having this system of, let's call it, social norm enforcement, where people are, quote, fined for things that are not literally criminal, but yet are very egregious and stuff that, you know, the community at large would very much disapprove of. This is kind of an interesting way where that feeling can be harnessed in order to sort of regulate behavior and discourage things that most people disapprove of. So yeah, if you think the community at large has an awful value system, then that might be a bad thing. But also, you know, just think about it. There's lots of things that people correctly don't like. And so there's lots of antisocial behaviors that would be minimized in such a system. And then all, you know, all the other benefits I mentioned that I won't reiterate right now. Let me mention the issue of crime families or the mafia taking over. For some reason, a lot of people, when they hear about a privatized legal and judicial system, they're worried that, oh yeah, that means the mafia would run rampant. No, it's the exact opposite. Right, both in movies that you might see about the mob, TV shows, and, you know, if you read real stories about them, what does the mob specialize in? It's areas that are regulated or prohibited by the government. Right, so the mob is not in the grocery business. The mob is not involved in selling economics lectures online. What is the mob involved in? It's involved in prostitution, gambling, drugs, and murder, right? Those things are all illegal or heavily regulated by the government. And so that's what the mob specializes in. During alcohol prohibition, the mob specialized in selling alcohol. They legalized it, boom, and now the mob has nothing to do with selling beer or wine. Okay, so in a libertarian society, as more and more things were legalized, ultimately everything was, quote, legalized in the sense of the state's not prohibiting it, the mob, far from taking over, would wither away and disappear. You picture a modern city like New York, there is no way crime families could exist in a system like that if it were free, right? The reason the crime families, again, work right now is because they have the gang of the NYPD cracking down on their competitors and keeping them afloat with payoffs. All right, but if it were just wide open and there was no state propping them up, the crime families would disappear. Or if you prefer, they would become legitimate. You know, so they would be led by market incentives to be more and more civilized, more and more businesslike, until after a while they would just be a business. It would never make sense to say, well, why don't we have a drive-by shooting, just like, you know, the people running Budweiser don't ever say, you know, these Heineken folks are moving in on our turf. Why don't we take out their CEO with machine guns? Like, they wouldn't even, you know, nobody would even think of suggesting that at a board meeting. It's stupid. That wouldn't gain you much, and you'd be risking a lot. Why would you do that? Right? Whereas it does make sense if you're selling heroin and someone's moving in on your turf, maybe just kill a guy. Again, but that's not because of heroin per se and its attributes. It's because heroin is in a prohibited market. And that's why it might make sense in a perverse way to take out somebody dealing heroin. Okay, so again, if you're worried about crime families for some reason, people bring that up. No, they would wither away in this kind of a framework. So what I'm getting at is all of the sources of conventional crime would be incredibly muted in the world I'm describing, right? Just think about it. There's no public schools, right? So there's no truancy laws. Nobody's forcing kids to go to school. And if they do choose to go to school, or their parents make them go to school, they're really good schools where they learn a lot of stuff and they don't just sit around wasting time and doing crazy things or, you know, get beaten up by gangs, right? There's no drug laws, right? So young kids are not enticed to join drug gangs, and there's no violence that they're seeing day in and day out. There's no housing projects. There's no massive disruption of certain families because the fathers are arrested and, you know, the kids grew up without a dad, both because of the welfare state and the drug war, right? So a lot of the things that contribute to crime right now would not be there anymore. There'd be no minimum wage laws, right? So everybody who wants to work could get a job right away, and then they could gain experience and move on up the ladder, all right? There wouldn't be the boom-bust cycle because you'd have sound currency. So just think about all the different ways that the state right now contributes to the crime problem. I'm saying those things would all be washed away. So people growing up in the kind of society I'm talking about, you know, if you're worried about all rampant axe murders or bank robbers or rapists and no, a lot of those factors would all be muted heavily. And then, yeah, the remaining problem cases we could deal with in a certain way. And also, too, just like in the current society right now, let's say somebody gets convicted of torturing people for weeks on end. Do we as a society say, well, what we're going to do is we're going to torture you too, and then we'll kill you? No, we don't say that. There's a sense in which we say, no, we're above that. We're civilized. We don't torture inmates, period. Okay, I don't care what you did. We don't torture you as a matter of policy. And so I'm saying in the kind of world I'm talking about, the kind of city I'm envisioning, it's just known among all the people, the good law-abiding folk, that, yeah, we don't use violence. Yeah, we know there are violent people. We're not naive. We know what happens. But we're just saying we choose not to use violence. There are ways we can deal with you that won't imperil us, and we don't have to use violence. We renounce it as a tool. And I'm saying in a society that I'm describing, I think that would be the natural outcome among the institutions, right? The major companies and so on, just for PR reasons, just for profitability. they would just say among their employees, just like the employees of a major company aren't going to swear at the customers, right? So in their private life, they could swear, but you know, you're dealing with somebody, you know, at the desk who's dealing with you as a customer, they're not going to start dropping F-bombs on you, right? They just don't do that. It's just not professional. And so I'm saying, likewise, I think the major institutions and their employees in a libertarian society, very quickly, it would just become unprofessional to use violence when dealing with members of the general public, even if they were criminals. Okay, so the last thing now to deal with is, what about a foreign invasion? You might say, okay, fair enough, Bob. Bank robbers, axe murderers, gangbangers, whatever. Maybe we could deal with them nonviolently, but what about, you know, some foreign government sends in bombers and tanks and what have you? All right, obviously, that's admittedly harder to deal with. But again, let me motivate this. There's this quote attributed to Bismarck where he apparently said, if the British army landed in Europe, I'd get the Belgian police to arrest them. Okay, so you can see what he's getting at there, that he's saying that, you know, that our forces, our land armies are so much superior to the piddling British army, as opposed to the British Navy, that yeah, if they landed in Europe, we would just have them arrested. Meaning we don't even have to fight them with our armies because it's a police action. Okay, so what would be more appropriate, of course, in my framework, there's not one person who's in charge that would say I would have them arrested. It would be something more like, oh, so if some foreign enemy, you know, some foreign army marched into our city, they would be arrested, right? You make it more of a statement like that, right? Because there's no one person that's in charge of the police forces. But then remember the way I described my vision of dealing with crime. It's more like, oh, if a foreign army came into our city that I'm talking about, they would be escorted off the property. And so here, my vision of this is, remember, you see it a lot in movies, right, where somebody is being obnoxious, like in a bar or a club or something, and then the camera switches to the street, and you see the front door of the establishment, and then the bouncers come, and they have the guy, and they just literally just throw him out into the street, you know, and he gets up, and he kind of brushes himself off, and he walks away, right? So that, to me, is a good metaphor for how an advanced anarcho-capitalist society would deal with some pesky little foreign state sending its troops into it. They would just be escorted off the property. So yes, folks, I have come full circle. How would I deal with a foreign army invading my country, Ancapistan? They would be physically removed. Hans Hermann Hoppe had the answer all along. Say what you will about that, but it's not cowardly, right? To say if somebody tried to invade this city I'm talking about, this society, they would be physically removed. That's what would happen. Now, let's talk about logistics or tactics. If the U.S. turned into Ancapistan next Thursday, and for some reason the Canadian military tried to invade at full power, yeah, they couldn't just be escorted off the property. There would have to be bloodshed, no doubt about it. But I don't think the Canadian military would choose to do that. Why would they choose to do that? Right? The U.S., the people living in the United States would be far less of a threat to the Canadians once they went Ancapistan than they are right now. So that's one thing. And every day that they were Rothbardian, they would be growing richer and richer. And so the gap between the Canadian and the American military forces would keep growing. So, we can quibble about a transition period here, but I'm saying a full-blown, developed Rothbardian society that has been there for 10 years, let's say, some outside state tries to invade, I mean, they would be facing people that were, what, 10 times per capita richer than them? And so think of it this way. I imagine many Rothbardians would be okay if I said the defending forces would be able to repel the invaders without suffering any casualties, right? Like, in other words, that's how tough and how superior technologically and in terms of their training the defending forces would be. Just like, you know, the best airplane designers would be in Ancapistan. The best computer programmers would be there. Likewise, the best military troops would be there. The best surface-to-air missiles, the best drones, the best mines. They're protecting the waters from naval invasion, right? All the things, the best radar, the best, you know, satellite-based lasers, what have you. All the ways that they would be able to repel invaders, that stuff would be light years ahead of the outside militaries relying on the political process to equip their troops and train them. And so I think you can see how, yeah, especially the longer we let the clock run, the more advanced the ANCAP people get, the more likely it is that they could repel invaders while suffering zero casualties. And so now I'm going to say, what would be even better? Imagine that not only do they suffer zero casualties, they repel the invaders, and the invaders don't suffer any casualties, right? So you see what I'm saying? That wouldn't be a mark of a wash. That would be humiliating. Can you imagine that? Like, some people roll in with tanks and whatever, and somehow, like, maybe they use, like, magnetic weaponry or something, and just turn off all the tanks. Like, maybe some kind of, like, targeted EMP blast, and all the enemy's equipment just fizzles out. And the troops come out and they're like, what the heck? And they have their machine guns and stuff. And then the defending forces approach them and they have cushions or something. And the enemy invaders are shooting machine guns and they're just like, these cushions are just absorbing the bullets. And they somehow all get encircled and they get tied up in nets. And they really don't even understand what happened. They get, you know, helicopters come overhead and drop foam bombs on them and stuff. And they get all gooey and they just can't even move. They're like getting molasses. And then the next thing they know, they're all like in handcuffs and they're in the back of a Jeep and they're getting driven and escorted off the property. And then they get dumped, you know, 10 miles outside the border of Ancapistan, and the guys dropping them off kind of slap them on the butt and say, hey, better luck next time, guys. Try again. And they get back and they drive back to the city. And then, like, their handcuffs open up 2 minutes later or something. And they're just sitting there dazed, completely disarmed, literally. And they realize, we just got physically escorted off the property. Like, do you know how demoralizing that would be? How embarrassing that would be? So, again, you know, you could say, oh, that's not realistic. But if you say that, I think you really don't believe then that the state is that big a deal. Because I think the state is an incredible parasite. I think human beings are unbelievably productive. You can't even imagine the capacity of what the human mind could produce if we could just remove the shackles of the state. And I'm saying a city of a million or more people. Think of how wealthy New York City is right now and how statist it is. That just shows you what humans are capable of when they collaborate, when they're brought in close proximity, millions of their minds interacting real rapidly together, even with the layers and layers of state bureaucracy that a modern American city has. Imagine you got rid of that. There's no taxes, and there's no right business regulations. Property owners can do whatever they want as long as it's voluntary. Can you imagine how productive those people would be? And you're saying, out of millions of people who are brainstorming, nobody's going to figure out a way to repel invaders without minimizing casualties on either side? I think you are vastly downplaying the harm of the state, if that's what you believe. If, in other words, you're just thinking, oh yeah, a free society would be 47% wealthier than now, in the military, you know, that their rockets would be 10% faster and their troops would be a little bit trained better. And it would be a quantum leap. It would be like the modern U.S. Army going and fighting ancient Rome or something. I mean, that's the level, or let's say Napoleon, if you think that's too much. Okay. Imagine the modern U.S. military fighting Napoleon. I mean, that's the kind of mismatch it would be. And so maybe I'm stretching a bit when I say zero casualties, but I'm saying it would be very little violence. And then the point is, once it happened, I mean, they could have public demonstrations. They could have war games among the competing defense agencies of the city and publicize it for the world to see. And so foreign militaries would realize there is no way we can touch them. So they wouldn't even bother trying to invade. Well, I've been going long here. Why don't I stop at this point? I hope I've at least, if not convinced you fully, opened your eyes up to the possibility that Rothbardian institutions would become nonviolent fairly rapidly. Thanks for listening, everybody. See you next time.
You've just experienced another episode of The Bob Murphy Show, the podcast promoting free markets, free minds, and grateful souls. For more information and to subscribe to this podcast, visit bobmurphyshow.com.